Boston is a city full of luminary writers, and among them is author Gish Jen. Gish is the author of 9 books, including The Resistors and Tiger Writing, and her newest book, Thank You, Mr. Nixon, which was released this year. Now, Thank You, Mr. Nixon is a collection of short stories spanning 50 years of Chinese-American relations, revisiting families and relationships as the world changes around them. So Gish joins us now. Gish, welcome to the show.
Oh, my pleasure. It's great to be back.
So the last time you were here on Radio Boston, it was 2020, and you were talking about The Resistors, which was this techno dystopia with baseball. So how did your creative life take you from there to this short story collection?
Well, as you know, right after I saw you, COVID hit, and there I am in a little cabin in Vermont. It's very, very quiet. And it's actually a wonderful moment to reflect. And it is a time when I can look at my own work and I realize that I had all these stories that were sort of begging to be collected. And sitting there, I suddenly realized that there was an arc to them. And, you know, it's funny, but for the quiet of COVID, I'm not sure that I would have seen the arc. But there it was, clear as day. And I realized that not only that there was an arc, but I also realized that the 50th anniversary of Nixon's visit to China was coming up. And I realized that I had almost all of the 50 years represented in my stories already. So I just had to write a few more stories. No, don't get me wrong. A few more. It was 5 more stories. But it was quiet, and I was by this lake in Vermont. I wasn't going out, and sure enough, I was able to write 5 stories in short order.
Might as well take advantage of that time, right?
Yes.
So this short story collection, again, spans 50 years of Chinese-American relations told mainly through perspectives of regular people experiencing those events. And you sort of plant this flag in your first short story, which centers on First Lady Pat Nixon's red coat.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that story and why you started there?
Well, you know, when we think about that first visit of President Nixon to China, you know, there's a lot of emphasis on what we saw in the United States, right? So, you know, we see this great state visit, but from the Chinese point of view, you know, what they were focused on was something very different. And I think that if there's anything that made an impression, it was Pat Nixon's red coat. Because there they were. It was a sea then of gray and navy blue and black. And, you know, the Chinese are famously lovers of red. Now, the communists have tried to stamp that out, you know, but honestly, in their heart of hearts, they still just loved red. And when Pat Nixon showed up in that coat, you know, their hearts just blew open in a way that's maybe hard for us to understand on the side of the world. But and I do think that, you know, that was the seeds. And when we look at today at the blossoming of capitalism, I think you can see it right there in that moment when, for all the indoctrination, they still just loved red and wanted to wear red and wanted to have all of that stuff in their lives.
As a reader of this particular story, I know I learned a lot. I didn't know a lot of that background and sort of cultural background of this. So I appreciated learning that while reading this first short story, too.
Well, dulce et utile, we say. That's from Horace. We're supposed to instruct and entertain.
So there is a theme that reappears throughout this collection in different ways. It's in that first story already to prepare for Nixon's visit. The protagonist, Tricia Tsang, is told very clearly to know what and what not to know and to forget the phrase American imperialists, and then also to pretend that things were different than they actually were. You know, I wonder if I could ask you to read a little bit from that section for us. And just to set this up a little bit for the listeners, this is Tricia's perspective writing a letter to President Nixon.
So Tricia Tsang was one of the girls. President Nixon very famously visited a park in Hangzhou, and it was a very beautiful park. Of course, as her point is that, you know, the whole China she saw was kind of a, he saw was kind of a Potemkin China, right? But anyway, and it was all staged, including the little girls that he would run into at the park. And Tricia Song was one of those little girls, and she's recalling that in this letter that she is now writing posthumously from heaven to Richard Nixon in hell. In any case, and so she's remembering that moment. She says, "The streets were cleaned up before you came, with certain slogans removed and new ones put up. The shelves of the stores were filled, and people were made to stay at school and work late so that the streets would not be so crowded. Did you notice how few people there were around? Maybe you thought that was normal. But it was not normal, just like the number of fish in Westlake was not normal. Did you think there were always so many beautiful carp waiting to be fed? Those of us students who were supposed to be background students in the park were told what to understand. What if the American journalists ask things like, 'Do you have enough to eat and drink?' or 'Do you like America?' our teacher asked us. Do you understand them?" Of course, that was a stupid question, because anyone who answered yes would not have been picked to be a background student to begin with. But no one said it was stupid. Instead, we promised that even if the translator spoke perfect Mandarin, we would not understand him. We were not supposed to understand anything about a man going to the moon either, which was easy since most of us did not actually know the American imperialists had put a man on the moon until we were told that we didn't know anything about it."
Well, as I want to have you touch on one thing, as a writer and a documenter, have you run up against that culture of intentional not knowing? Do you see threads of that in China today?
Oh, my God, of course. We have, you know, they conveniently don't know, and things are conveniently inconvenient, you know. So you see this all the time. You know, the Chinese, you know, they do not like address things directly often. They often prefer a more indirect manner of expression. And so, yes, this business of "I don't know" when you know perfectly well they know, that happens all the time.
Well, and it's also interesting that this theme of being under watch or being surveilled, you know, that was also very present in the resistors. Was that intentional for you as a writer? And is that something that you wrestle with in your own life, maybe?
Well, of course, I mean, the business of surveillance is very much part of our lives now, you know, because of technology. And I think I maybe was more than usually acutely aware of it because I have spent so much time in China. So, you know, and as you can see from this book, surveillance has been a big part of Chinese life since for many, many years. So it was very apparent to me from my very first visit in China, which is 1979, just as in one of the stories in this book, you know, there are hall monitors at the end of every hall, and they are watching everything that you do and reporting. And you can see that, you know, for them to go to cameras, it was just a hop, skip, and a, you know, I mean, it was just, they were doing it already. Technology's just enabled to do it even better.
Well, and I want to shift gears here a little bit and talk about Betty Koo's story. Uh-huh. Her family story is explored. It's the very last short story in this collection, Detective Dog, it's called. I understand that you added this one kind of at the last minute. You know, it includes subjects like COVID and other more recent events. So tell me a little bit more about how that got added in and, you know, how we ended up seeing some of these details.
Yeah, well, Betty Koo, of course, is already, you know, Tina Koo and her kids, Betty and Bobby Koo, and her husband, Johnson Koo. Anyway, they all appear in the book earlier. But it is true that, you know, I already had 10 stories and I was all set. The book was already sold to Knopf. And I still felt that, you know what, I couldn't publish this book without talking about Hong Kong, really. And COVID, and those two things came together in the story. That, you know, some of these stories wrote themselves very, very quickly, and this is one of them. I mean, I don't know how long it took me, but it was definitely not more than 10 days, so it was very fast, maybe a week. And I think that when you see that as a writer, when you see that, you know, you yourself have something bottled up that you just really have to say. So I think this idea that I wasn't done was accurate. I just wasn't done.
So let's talk about this one, because, you know, there's a lot of threads that we've talked about. The first thread in that is anti-Asian racism. And I can see how that might come up, you know, with COVID and also Hong Kong. So what pushes our main characters to move from the U.S. to Montreal in your book?
From the U.S. They move from Hong Kong. To Vancouver,
right.
To
yes.
Vancouver, and they moved because of the unrest in Hong Kong, but they moved from Vancouver to New York because of racism, you know, and that's just, you know, I'm sorry to say that this is a very common story, but they are in New York and they're actually getting along fine, you know, I mean, there are a lot of ironies, as you know, I mean, their child is, you know, because of COVID, he's president of the anti-racism club, and his, you know, he's like 10 years old, and, you know, they want him to be the president of the club because the Chinese are the most racist, and he agrees. so he'll be president.
Well, and you can almost feel the claustrophobia, you know, during COVID and the remote learning. So can you dive in deeper to this? Like, tell us how the different members of the Ku family relate to Hong Kong independence and how they're watching from afar.
Well, they're watching from afar. You know, it's very hard for them because, you know, they're looking at the footage and you know, especially the older son, who has such, you know, strong ties to Hong Kong. You know, he's looking for his friends, and he's aware that if he were there, he would absolutely be on the streets. And he's furious at his parents that they have a more complacent view. Of course, you know, you see all the intergenerational tension in that, you know, the parents are a little more like, you know, safety first, let's just get out of there, you know, and he's much more like, how can you just go on and act like nothing is happening? And, you know, he's absorbed a lot from his international education, and he feels like he's outraged that they're not more upset about the Uyghurs and the whole thing, you know. They're just like, we just want you to be here and safe. And I don't want to give away the story, but, you know, of course, things do explode.
Well, so we've explored this 50-year arc in your book, from Pat Nixon's red coat all the way to the present, COVID, Hong Kong protests. So can you say a little bit more about, or how would you describe that, rather, that arc of getting from the beginning to the end and how they might experience that?
Well, of course, it's a number of different families involved in this book. But in a general kind of way, you know, you do, I hope to capture the enormous excitement of this opening of the East to the West and what that meant, how strange it was, how much promise there was. And then, you know, trace it all the way to this moment where, you know, frankly, I think we're very disappointed and quite worried. You know, that said, I hope that there's also kind of a reminder in this book that, you know, a lot can happen in 50 years, you know. So bleak as things look now, you know, they may not stay that way. And I think if we've seen anything with China, it is that things happen quickly.
So you've mentioned before that you feel like you have this new self-confidence to write about China in a way that you hadn't before. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Well, let me just say, first of all, the fact that I just went ahead and wrote about Hong Kong, I did burn a bridge when I did that, you know, so I cannot go to the back of the mainland now. You know, that story was in The New Yorker, it's way too public. And so there's just a way in which I said what I had to say. I'm glad I said it. It did cost me something. Something very dear to me. I have a lot of relatives in China still. It really pains me that I can't go back. But there is a kind of freedom there in that, you know, that is who I am. I am against this kind of repression. I have to speak up. And, I feel a kind of peace with myself, I guess.
Well, when we asked you first to come on the show, we had this idea that we'd also talk to you about books that you recommend that demonstrate this trend and this new self-confidence. Excuse me, this new self-confidence. But you actually got in touch with us over the weekend, too. And you said no, that you actually wanted to talk about books that are filled with rage. So with that in mind, what do you recommend?
Well, you know, I have been looking at a lot of the new releases, and it is really amazing, I think, how many of the books on the shelves just right now, you know, deal with all the issues that are in the news. Starting with Tracy Flick Can't Win, Tom Perrotta. As you probably know, this is a wonderful, funny portrait of high school politics that it does end quite tragically. Very sadly, these days, as soon as you say high school and tragedy, we sort of know where he's going. Mercy Street by Jennifer Hay, you know, which is a portrait of an abortion clinic in Boston. Again, you get to see many of the forces at play: poverty, religion, nostalgia, and last but not least, misogyny. A Horse by Geraldine Brooks. This is a fantastic book about an 1850s racehorse that's also very much about race. Toggles between the horse's enslaved groom, a mid-century modernist art gallery owner, and a contemporary scientist and art historian. It's a really wonderful way. I hear the music coming up. Does that mean I can't recommend any more books?
Sadly, it does.
Oh, my God. Break my heart. Maybe we can list them online.
We can put them on our website. So fear not. That was Gish Jen, the author of the short story collection. Thank you, Mr. Nixon. You can find out more about her book, including a link to a recent WBUR City Space conversation she participated in, on our website, radioboston.org. Gish, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.